Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilda Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accelerating social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I am so pleased to welcome Alberto Ibarguen as my guest on Making Change. Alberto's decades of experience have spanned so many aspects of community participation, from legal aid lawyer and community organizer to newspaper publisher, and now as president and CEO of the Knight Foundation. Given the many hats he has worn in a lifetime dedicated to doing good in the world, it is my pleasure to have Alberto Ibarguen share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Alberto Ibarguen. Welcome, Alberto. It's nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you tell our listeners, they know who you are officially, but can you tell a little bit about the path that brought you to your current position?
Well, that path gets longer all the time. In real life, I'm a recovering lawyer, having spent 5 years between college and law school in the Peace Corps in Latin America, and I was a legal aid lawyer and community organizer in Hartford, Connecticut in the mid and late 70s. And then in the way that life works, I ended up practicing law. I was first executive officer of the Connecticut Elections Commission. I was deputy general counsel of a bank. And one day I got a call about being the senior VP and lawyer for the local newspaper, the Hartford Courant. And that's how I moved over, went to the Hartford Courant. And a year later, they asked me to move to New York, which is where I was from. And that led to a fantastic almost 12 years at Newsday, as Newsday was going into New York City, or then coming to Miami, first as publisher of the Spanish language newspaper here, El Nuevo Herald, and then subsequently added responsibility for the Miami Herald. I left the Miami Herald 7 years ago and became president of Knight Foundation.
A meandering path indeed. As you look back over all of that time, coming out of legal aid and community organizing, looking at the newspaper industry and how that has changed over time and what your positions have been now at the Knight Foundation, when you see change happening, what do you see undergirding that change? What are the factors that you see really contributing to change when it's really happening?
When I look at projects that or programs that really have impact, there are characteristics that are similar in the process. There are 5 points: discovery, vision, courage, know-how, and tenacity. These are in programs that have transformational impact on community. There's the discovery, that is the journalism, the reporting, the basing of an idea on facts, things as they are, not as you wish they were, not as your theory of the game may tell you they ought to be, but as they really are. A vision to see what others don't, to see the same set of facts and see a different way forward. The courage to put yourself out. It so often is the case that things that have transformational impact simply require a great deal of courage, because the fact that others haven't seen it by definition makes your presentation of it something of an act of courage. The know-how to either get it done, or the ability to find the know-how to get it done. And then perhaps the most important of all is tenacity, because social change takes time. It's one of the biggest problems I find with the cycles of philanthropy, that we tend to work in organizations that have calendar years or fiscal years, and social change doesn't work on that kind of a schedule. Sometimes there's a great event, a Katrina, or now perhaps in New York a Sandy, but certainly a Katrina in Biloxi, and that creates the opportunity for accelerated social change. But usually it is a much slower process and a much more organic process than an annual budget. So if you're looking for impact, and if you're trying to create social change, I think you would almost certainly find each of those characteristics in successful projects.
When you mention that an event like a Katrina, or as we're seeing now, a Sandy, creates the opportunity for accelerated social change, I'm wondering what it is about that that allows the change to happen. Because it's not just that it accelerates action in response to the crisis. It seems to accelerate change beyond that. I'm wondering what you see going on that allows that to happen.
I think it opens imagination. It makes people willing to consider things that when they perceived they had something to lose, or when they perceived that they had something to change from, they weren't really willing to do it. I think the perspective is, before I had a house, now I have a slab of cement. Before I had a community, Katrina raised Biloxi. Mm-hmm. I was there a few days after the storm, and the ocean swept in and went right out and took with it virtually the whole front of that town, leaving trash and I remember rags in the branches of the once great live oaks that they have on the beach, slab after slab of concrete where houses had been, never mind the casinos that had been offshore, the whole buildings were swept onshore, literally blocks from where they had once stood in the water itself. And so people are able to imagine things with a clean slate that they simply couldn't imagine before or wouldn't want to. And wouldn't want to because it's familiar, because it's the way we do things in this town, whatever this town is. It's the way we are in this community. Well, all of a sudden, this event comes in, this natural event comes in, catastrophe happens, and people are open to new ideas. What we did there it's kind of a funny story. I'm from the newspaper business. So a disaster happens, and what do you do in the newspaper business? You go look at it, put it in the paper the next day. The day after that, somebody writes an editorial on what we ought to do. And then you go on to the next triple axe murder. That's the nature of the newspaper business. So when this happened, I, of course, flew to Mobile. I rented a Ford truck. I drove to Biloxi. I slept in the parking lot of the Biloxi Times-Herald. And I met people. I watched. I saw. The editor of the paper came in early one morning and said, I've got all these papers in hand. And each one of these pieces of paper is a story. My job is to figure out how to put them together, give people a sense of community, and give people a sense of hope that we can go forward from here. Wow. I thought, perfect. That is perfect. That is exactly what we ought to do as a community. And I told anybody who'd listen, if you wanted to get together and work in that sort of way, because you could tell billions of dollars were going to come in, you could tell that Mississippi was going to have to allow casinos on land, and if they were going to come on land, they were going to control everything unless the community early on had an opportunity to have a say-so on what their community was going to look like. So I said, anybody who wants to play that way, call me up, we'll help support. So I come back to Miami, I get a call from Susan Beresford, who was then the president of Ford Foundation, and she was laughing through this conversation. She said, what are you doing going to the scene of the disaster? You're a foundation president now. You're supposed to be for the white paper. And she laughed and said, now, but as long as you went down there, come on up here and tell me about it. So I talked with Susan and her staff when my phone rings, and it's Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. And in an accent I wish I could imitate, the governor tells me that he had decided to form a commission that would bring citizens together with experts. He was going to have Jim Barksdale chair it, the former head of Netscape, previously had been head of Federal Express, a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. Haley Barbour said he was going to have an architect named Andres Duany from Miami, who had done lots of charrettes after Hurricane Andrew. And what they do in these charrettes is they bring everybody together. They draw a picture of the way we could go forward with a about a problem, about a community, about a neighborhood, about a whole town. And we had an opportunity. They had an opportunity in southern Mississippi to reimagine whole parts of their community. So he wanted to get this thing going right away, in part to get started, in part to give people hope, and in part because billions of dollars were going in. And if you have no roadmap, they might just get spent anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so I said, Governor, I had a little bit of an out-of-body experience because I was in my job. I was in this foundation job about a month at that
point. Oh, yeah.
And I said, Governor, you get Barksdale and you get Duany and I'll pay for it. And he paused, I paused, and I thought, who said that? And he said, well, now, son. He probably didn't say son, but something like, well, now, son, this isn't going to be tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands.
Right.
This is going to be some real money that's going to be required. And I quickly recovered and I said, well, Governor, if Knight Foundation can't pay for the whole thing, I'll figure out who can. 3 weeks later, we had 200 architects, engineers, citizens in what remained of the Isle of Capri Hotel and Casino. They did 7 days, 11 charrettes for 11 communities. They then spent the better part of the next month doing 100 plus community meetings. And in the first week of December, Barksdale presented to Governor Barbour a blueprint for the redevelopment of the southern coast of Mississippi. It gave people a sense of direction. It gave people a sense of order. And most importantly, it gave people hope.
And I really am seeing the signs of all of the 5 points that you talked about inside of there. The discovery, the basing ideas on things as they are. Certainly, you had no choice but to do that. And I think that big piece of seeing what others don't see, seeing that ability to bring people together quickly, and the bringing people together. I mean, that's such a huge piece of it.
There have been a lot of lessons in my own evolution of how I think about the work of the foundation. I think I have a greater respect for the value of collaborations and of networks. I have a continuing huge respect for the value of an idea, the value of the visionary, the social entrepreneur who sees but who needs to be connected to a network in order to have sustainable growth. I think all of those are things that have evolved in my own mind and have influenced my thinking at Knight. But one of the things that I didn't used to think about and think about now quite a lot is that our business here is to not confuse ourselves with the founder. I'm not Jack Knight. This is not my money. I am managing an arrangement that Jack Knight made with the IRS for community betterment. I do things that are social investments. And so as a social investor, I take a very different attitude than I would if I were doing charity. And it's not to say in any way that I have anything against charity. I practice it myself, but this is a different thing. If I am running a foundation of this kind as a social investor, I need to demand a return. The return is not the return of the money. In fact, if you return my money, I have an IRS problem. So I don't want that. What I want is a return in terms of the impact on the community. And that creates a different kind of organization as a foundation, a different set of expectations. It makes assessment and the dissemination of learning far more important than if you were doing charity. You've got to check to see that it happened, figure out what the impact is, and then figure out how to use the learning going forward. And it applies whether you're doing arts programs, community programs, or as we do, journalism and media innovation programs. I'm not interested just in the fact that we may have trained some journalists. I'm interested in what those journalists did when they went back to their newsroom. And furthermore, I'm interested in what they did in those newsrooms to make better the lives of their readers.
I'm curious if you've got any examples of a return that you have seen from non-crisis. We clearly see what happened in Biloxi. Looking at non-crisis situations, any examples, any stories of return that you have seen that you're excited about?
I want to say one other thing, and it's about donor intent, because Jack Knight was a Middle Western values, solid guy. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful speech that he gave to the Akron Chamber of Commerce about 60 plus years ago, where he talked about the purpose of a great newspaper being to inform and illuminate the minds of its readers so that the people may determine their own interest. Mm-hmm. So it's from that we take our marching orders as Knight Foundation, because he and his brother actually said and wrote comparatively little about what they expected us to do, except they cared about journalism and they cared about communities. And so we seek to support projects that inform communities so that they may determine their own interests and engage in ensuring that those interests are carried out, which is why our slogan is informed and engaged communities. Gotcha. So in the areas of information, we decided early on that teaching best practices for a world we didn't understand was probably not the best use of Jack's money. And so we began to invest heavily in a series, now literally hundreds, of experiments for the delivery of news and information on digital platforms. And we began by doing it through the device of a contest that had three rules: ideas to deliver news and information on digital platforms. And it was as open as that, because if we had done a set of rules, we would simply get back variations on things we had already imagined. And we really, in a different enough world, that we simply had to be open to ideas that we couldn't imagine. It worked out exactly that way. And as a result, we have funded, as I say, literally hundreds of examples, some of them online news operations like Texas Tribune or Voice of San Diego, MinnPost, Bay Citizen in San Francisco. Some of them are devices, applications, if you will. Most of them, however, fall into the category of, okay, that was interesting, but it's not really sustainable, is it? Mm-hmm. And so we keep looking. We have found new partners in MIT. You probably never thought of MIT as a journalism school. But the Media Lab is a place where I think they are helping to invent the future of communications. And so our search is for the ways that people will use information, mindful of the way that changes values, mindful of the way that changes the way people not just use information, but value information. And with those insights, looking for programs to fund that will ultimately lead to a more informed community. It has been also a really interesting development that openness that we were forced into by the reality of the changing media landscape has then affected our arts program. And then in our communities program, our effort to use technology for engagement has led us to, I think, a much more responsive kind of funding. In Macon, Georgia, for example, we started out responding to a sense of some students at Mercer University that the nearby neighborhood was something that could be improved. Mm-hmm. The engagement of citizens, the participation of the university, and the engagement of the downtown community. It has been a 12, 15-year process. But if you go to Macon now and you look at that Beals Hills neighborhood, which is a livable, walkable, safe community now, which it wasn't then. It is a neighborhood that is growing in prosperity. We are merging the different parts of our foundation and sort of all coming at the problem from different perspectives. And a good example of that is the moving of the newspaper in town into a university building that also includes the addition of Georgia Public Radio, all in the same building with the students. I think it's a very exciting project. I don't know if it'll work. We're supporting it, obviously. I don't know if it'll work, but I think it is an interesting experiment for us to see if that doesn't create a better informed and then hopefully a more engaged Macon, Georgia, to give you an example.
One of the things that I am noticing as you're telling these stories is that so frequently what we find in the foundation world is that very short term, we're going to fund a project and we want to see whatever result, and we don't even know how we're going to measure the result. But if you tell us there's a result, we'll say, okay, and we'll put it in the file. And what I'm sensing from the example that you gave of doing a contest to just look at ideas that deliver ideas and information on different digital platforms, what I'm sensing that came out of that is that you guys didn't just say, okay, here's a bunch of things that we funded, and this one looks like it worked, and this one looks like it didn't work. That what you did was you leveraged all of those together to create, what are we learning out of all of these? How can we then connect that to other ideas? Because I'm sure MIT, you're pulling MIT into it now. You're pulling all, you're creating, in essence, an ecosystem of ideas to see what creates results, to see what sustains. Then, obviously, you're having that affect how you do your other philanthropy. There's really this sort of cyclical and ecosystem sense that I'm getting, all based on the fact that none of these are in silos, that you're really seeing the whole of all of this.
You've stated it exactly as I wish it were. It's really a bumpy road.
Well, ecosystems are not, you know, the interesting thing that we always hear, oh, the social change stuff is messy. And we've really come to the fact that, no, it's not messy unless you think of any ecosystem as messy. Well, of course it's messy. I mean, life is not linear and ecosystems are not linear. So we've really come in our office to think about things as an ecosystem, that it's rich and it's fertile and it's not linear and it's not clean. So your messiness is a cool thing.
But you're stating it exactly right. And one of the things that sometimes helps to drive our staff a little bit crazy is that I really am pretty comfortable with the ambiguity required if you take the approach you just described, because you don't know. When you put an amoeba under a microscope and poke it, you don't really know where that little thing is going to move. You don't know if it's going to move east, west, you know, north or south, and in what kind of volume. Well, this is a little bit that way. We fund a completely different kind of project. We've funded Kaboom. Kaboom builds playgrounds. I don't care about playgrounds, but I really care about the group of neighborhood, usually women, who get together and say, you know what, we have this space, we ought to build a playground for the kids. They get organized, they build the playground, they have a tangible proof that they can get things done, and that group then moves on to what? Maybe it's neighborhood security, maybe it's keeping the supermarket open so that hourly workers who can't get there during the day have some time to shop for fresh produce at night. Whatever the issues are that I cannot know sitting in my office in Miami, but they do know because they're in the neighborhood. And that kind of engagement, I think, is, to me, just fits so beautifully with the digital age that we're living in.
It is really incredible to listen to the consistency, and I'm smiling and so pleased that you shared at the beginning of this interview the journey that you've taken in your life, because there's community organizing in every one of these stories. There's building those rich ecosystems, those engaged communities, whether it is in Macon, Georgia, whether it is the work that you're doing with Kaboom, whether it's the work that you did at post-Katrina, the joy of listening to not only bringing together and building on the knowledge that's already in those communities. But the fact that you as a foundation are learning from that and trying to then see what's next, I really am so grateful that you were able to be with us today, Alberto, and I so look forward to following what you guys continue to learn. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Hildy. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for all you do.
Listening to Alberto's stories, it becomes clear that the five characteristics he noted that are present when projects are successful in creating change, all five of those characteristics are present in every story he shared. Discovery, vision, courage, know-how, tenacity, they're all at the heart of each of those successful efforts. There seem to be several lessons in that. The first is obviously the value of paying attention to those five characteristics. The balance between having a vision for what's possible, the courage to stick with that vision even in the face of those who believe it's impossible, the dedication to learning everything you can about how to proceed. Alberto's stories show the value of seeking out efforts with those qualities. But more important is that these aren't just some nice words, they're actually lived. The successful projects Alberto described show what can happen when we actually walk the talk of what we say we believe. And as he points out, that's not always easy. Our own board at Creating the Future does its best to be consistent in walking the talk of our own theory of change. But that also makes us realize how easy it can be to stray, to step back to what's comfortable when things feel uncertain. We're all only human. The energizing thing, though, is what happens when we surround ourselves with others who will help us hold ourselves accountable to walk that talk. In case after case, Alberto spoke of partners with shared vision, shared values, each holding themselves and each other accountable for what they would accomplish together. Which leads to questions for your own work. Does a theory of change guide your work? What do you believe are the prerequisites to the difference you intend to make, the conditions that need to change? What must people value in order for your vision for the community to become reality? Next, if you do have a theory of change, do you do your best to live that theory in your own day-to-day work? If you want to see change in others, are you walking the talk of that change yourself? Are you being the future you want to see? And finally, do you have feedback systems for holding yourselves accountable for walking that talk? Sometimes the simplest system is just to allot 15 minutes at your board meeting or staff meeting to ask those critically important questions. What do we believe will create the change we want to see in our community? What assumptions do we want to guide our actions? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter @HildyGottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hildy Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.